Hello and welcome to the Jazz Podcast. Today we're talking to Elliot Henshaw and Simon Niblock about their brand new album. This is the band Spice Fusion, of which they are co-conspirators. The album is Trying Hard 2. This episode is dedicated to my mum, because I think she's going to absolutely love this album. I'm your host, Rob Coke, and without further ado, let's talk to the chaps about this marvellous creation. Henshaw, Simon Niblock, welcome to the Jazz Podcast.
Hey, nice to be here. Thank you for having us.
So, we're talking about your new album.
Yes.
So, tell us everything. What's it called? What's the band called?
The band is called Spice Fusion, and the new album is called Trying Hard 2.
Right.
The first album was called Trying Too Hard.
Oh, amazing!
Which is a track that I wrote, which is on the first album. We wanted a little play on words, so Trying Hard 2. But it's not Trying Hard T-double-O, it's Trying Hard number 2, which we thought was quite clever.
I think that's amazing.
I like that.
Yeah.
I was quite pleased with that.
Is it the same... When was the first album released?
When?
Yeah.
4 years. I think it's 4 years since we did the first album, which was actually... It was actually started off life as a demo after we did our first gig. We had this gig come in, or a Sunday lunchtime blow band thing. We put together all our mates, and it just went so amazingly well that we thought, we've got to go into the studio and record this. And we went into Core Studios in Acton and got all the guys, and they sort of came on a very hot bank holiday and donated their services. But it came out so well that we decided to actually release it. You know, we had incredible... A range of players, London-based players there.
So that original demo actually became the album?
Became the first album.
And we didn't actually start recording until about 11:30, but the whole album was down by 5:00. It was just
I think it's 9 tracks on that album, is it?
All
the full big band in one live room, drum booth with the bass player in there going through a DI, percussion booth, keyboards going in DI, and we did it all as live.
Even the solos were done live. I was sitting next to Sean Freeman, who did a couple of amazing solos, and I was like, "There, I can't believe you're getting this live."
Yeah.
And it all came on so well, and there was very little editing going on at all. That's why we ended up releasing it, because it just came out so incredibly well. The only thing we did afterwards on that, we overdubbed some. Maybe we got Andy Rumble to do a couple of piano solos, and of course the singers. We had to get the singers, because a big feature of the band is the fact that we do have a variety of singers.
Yeah,
Annabelle Flowers and Ian McKenzie, Damien Floyd,
Wayne Hernandez, Miranda, and
Julie McGuire. You know, so we got a pool of singers who are obviously involved with it. So it gives the band a different flavour and opens up the avenues for all sorts of different kinds of music with it for them as well. It's a great vehicle for them.
So. Yeah. So that is such a great way to record an album, when you get that sense of spontaneity. You know, if you overdub a solo separately 8 times, it kind of loses its energy.
Well, without sort of going too much into detail about it, but there was a couple on the second album that we performed live, and it was actually blistering live. We got the video footage of the live gig, but when we came to doing the studio, it's really hard to sort of get, particularly when you've got to steam in on a solo, and it's like on the cold light of day, and it's 11:00 on a January morning or whatever. You know, it's hard to just get that same energy like you were in a nightclub with the band behind you kicking off. You know, but that's once again we thank the calibre of the player that we've got involved with the project, because they can do that. You know, they can just turn it on. Their ability is incredible. You know.
When did you record this album?
So the first one, or the
second one?
The second one.
The new one.
We recorded it over a lot. You see, we did it a different way to the first album. The second one has been remotely recorded.
Right.
So we did, like, I put all the drums down first, and that was probably done probably 18 months ago.
It's a testament to your ability. I mean, I can't get over how he does this, because the whole thing starts off with the MIDI files from my Sibelius scores.
Yeah.
And then Chris Trades, the producer, he adds a verbal click and everything onto it all. And Elliot, who knows the charts in his head, he knows exactly when the brass are coming in, or what where the stabs are. Yeah. And everything. He's got that arrangement in his head.
Yeah.
So they've got a great foundations for the rest of the guys to put their stuff over the top, because when you listen to the album, you'd never believe it was done separately like that, because you know the drummer at that foundation level is laying it down, and he knows, he can feel the horns there, even though it's just like the MIDI on the from the computer.
It's such a ridiculous skill. I remember hearing it's a Peter Erskine thing. It's like Vince Mendoza album called Epiphany. And you've got, like, on the photo on the back, if you look really closely, Mike Brecker's not with the rest of the band, he's like cut in separately. And after I noticed that, I went back, I listened to it again, and I was like, oh my god, you know, Erskine's playing all this stuff like there's something going on, and there's nothing. It's just been total silence.
It's a hard thing to do that, but we figured with this second album we would have we'd have more control over certain editing things if it was all done kind of separately. B, it's a lot cheaper. We hired although we did the first album in kind of one day at Core Studios in Acton, that's an expensive place to hire, you know. We figured a lot of our guys that play on our records now have got home studios. And they, bless them, they all give their time for very little, if any money at all, because they're so into the project. And you can just send it through to them. They can take their time with it, put their parts down, it comes back, there's very little stuff to be done afterwards. And again, it's testament to Chris Traves, our producer, who you know, engineered it, mixed it, mastered it. I mean, he played all the trombones on it as well, that he makes it sound like, because so many people have said, oh, God, you know, that's a big old lineup. Whereabouts did you record that? Is it Abbey Road 1? Is it, you know? Nice. The bass player recorded his up in Preston. It's Simon Goulding. The keys player, he's down in South London somewhere, isn't he? I did mine in South London in a separate room. You know, the trumpets were in Richmond. Tom Walsh and Andy Greenwood layered up all the trumpets together.
Do they that at home?
Yeah, Tom's got a little setup at home.
Oh, amazing.
Andy Greenwood came over to his place. They put their stuff down.
It's incredible when you add up the amount of musicians that are involved with this project and all the different studios that are involved with it. It's crazy. You know, maybe 10 or 11 different locations for recording for the same track. For me, it's always amazing. You press play in the studio and it all sounds like it's all done together. You know, the guys that sort of like know how to lock in and groove and give it that extra bite. Because the one thing about the band is that we like the band to have a sort of like real sort of bite and punch about it, like it is a live gig. I like to think of it as quite edgy and you know.
And I think with the guys we've got in the band now, we kind of cherry pick who we want to, you know, almost every part that Simon writes is for a specific person in mind when he's writing, because he knows their strengths. But all the guys that do it are top session guys, so they're used to going in on various types of TV session or film session or pop session or whatever it is, and knowing how to do that, because you know, how many albums are recorded with a band all in the same room at the same time these days? I mean, even pop records aren't done so much nowadays. And as it's a self-funded thing, you know, we wanted this time to spend a little bit more money on the post-production, and also, you know, a little bit of money on marketing and getting it out there, rather than spending the money on hiring a posh studio and getting everyone together. You know, we felt that everyone did such a wonderful thing for us on the first album by giving up their bank holiday to be all in one room at the same time. We felt we couldn't really ask that of them again, and we didn't want to ask that of them again. You know, as I'm sure that they'd have all probably said yes, but just think, you know, it was nice to do it. Looking back, and we've got strings on this album. We didn't have strings on the first album.
Oh, nice.
Well, that was one thing. We wanted to take it to the next level. We are not. We were hugely proud of the first album, but we were aware of the fact it was done initially as a demo.
Yeah.
So it was sort of like, in a way, it was sort of rushed out. So we cherry-picked a lot more the material that was going to be on it. And I've always wanted, you know, I've always hated the concept of, like, oh, they did the first album, but the second one wasn't quite as good kind of thing, you know.
Yeah.
I wanted it to, every album should take it to the next level. And one of the main things for me, it's a glorious thing to do, which was not, we don't often work in that world, is to have the strings involved, because that adds that extra sheen. And I'm very lucky and privileged that we, you know, sort of people like Oliver Lewis and Lucy Morgan managed to get the most amazing string section together for the day. And once again, did a whole album in a day, you know.
In actual fact, we did end up doing the string session at Core Studios, where we felt, where we recorded the first album.
Oh, great.
But what happened there was, I'd done some sessions at Core, and I'd said to them, listen, rather than paying me for these sessions, can I have a free studio day?
Wow.
And they said, well, yeah, that's cool.
That's
so
amazing.
I just used that free studio day, and we got all the strings down, and we had a day there recording strings.
And he wasn't even there.
I wasn't even there.
Yeah, so Chris Trace conducted it, and I was sort of overseeing the duties on that one. But
and again, we had Chris Traves conducting the strings. So Chris Traves produced the album, mixed it, mastered it, played all the trombones, conducted the strings. He's a good guy to know, Chris Traves.
Yeah.
Really. I mean, how many times have we mentioned Chris Traves?
Well,
he should be paid us commission.
I'll invoice him after.
So how many tracks are on the album?
There's 11 tracks on the album, on the CD at the moment.
Right.
But we're just in... Splash Fusion is a democracy amongst everybody involved. We always put it so that a lot of things to the vote, even what tracks we were originally going to put on the album. Even when we got David Benoit, the American pianist, involved with it, and we sat down in the studio and decided which track was going to be the best for the band for him to do. So that the Smarty Pants, which was originally from the Russ Freeman and David Benoit project album, I did an arrangement of that, and so anyway, there were 11 tracks, but we're actually going to go to vinyl on it now. 33 records are just taking us on. Paul Jolly there's very kindly taken us on to put it on the vinyl. So
will that just be the vinyl release on the label?
It's going to be a separate vinyl release,
right?
Because he, with his company, he's going to be releasing it in Japan as well, so we're looking forward to
amazing to
getting over to Japan. We're all big fans of Japan here at Spice Fusion, and particularly Chris Traves as well, you know. Thank you for saying that again, Chris Traves. You can edit out a few Chris Traves if
I'll
you
beat
want.
Them.
Yeah, because, well, I mean, sort of, I met my wife as well when I was working with the Matthew Herbert Big Band to the Blue Note in Tokyo. We were there for 5 days, and it was just the most amazing experience to work there and be there and everything.
Yeah.
So the thought of taking Spice Fusion to that location would be a dream come true for us. That's for sure.
Yeah.
Another one, you're right for now.
I'll have
a small latte.
Low fat cappuccino, please.
Same size, medium. No chocolate,
No chocolate.
Do you have any decaf?
Yeah.
Decaf, like small, would be great. Latte.
Small
something.
Lattes, more decaf latte, and the same fruit.
Low fat cappuccino.
Very good.
So the Japan thing.
The Japan thing. So we're getting distribution out there through 33 Jazz.
So will this now be like UK and Japan?
Yes.
Or, okay, cool.
Yes, the UK and Japan. I think Paul Jolly at 33 Jazz was saying that he could probably get us into Europe distribution as well.
Yeah.
I mean, any help like that is like gold dust, because it's so hard, you know, doing this all ourselves. You know.
We have this conversation on the pod a lot about how punishing our line of work is, that you're expected to do so many things beyond... When we all started, you're just in a practice room, like, trying to learn some notes, and now you're like publicizing your own album and trying to distribute book gigs. You know,
you learn as you go along.
Yeah,
it's crazy, you know. And I'm still trying to get the drums together, let alone do all this. You know, I still
where to put them.
In a skip. I moved house recently, and I've got a studio at the bottom of the garden now with a couple of drum sets here. I've not had live drum sets at home since I was at my parents when I was a teenager.
Yeah.
And I finally got that set up, but I've got a desk in there. And I must say, when I go into that office space or that studio space now, I'd probably say 70% to 30% I'm behind the desk than I am behind the drums doing practice, because you've got to
It's a business, as I was saying. Yeah. You know, we treat music as a business. You're practicing, you're bookkeeping, and you know, looking at taking care of business is a it should be treated like a business. You know, and certainly I'm like that. When, even though I work from home arranging, I still got a strict regime, as I'm always at that computer at 9 o'clock yeah. in the morning. But yeah. the good thing for me is I only have to walk like. Yeah. 10 feet to the office, yeah. so that's good. But it has to be like that. The way we kept moving forward, even with like, this project, is that we have that sort of business-like attitude towards it. I think.
Yeah.
And I think it's important to do that. You know. And I think, you know, as my mum used to say, it's no point being a flame under a bush. You know. And I think you've got to keep getting it out there and keep yeah. working hard at it all the time.
Yeah.
And of course, we've had so many we get knockbacks all the time. You know. Despite all our connections in the business and the experience that we have, we're still getting knocked back. Some people yeah. can't believe that we haven't got jazz festivals in the book and yeah. everything, you know. But we're doing everything we can, but the problem is convincing people, you know,
yeah.
all the time and knocking on the doors. And, you know, we're going to get a few no's, but hopefully yeah. a few doors will open along the way. And it's a very slow burn thing.
Yeah.
It is. And we wouldn't do it if we didn't love it. You know, we're really proud of the product.
Yeah.
We're proud of the band. And we love the music. You know, it's a chance for us.
Well, it sounds ridiculous, what I've listened to. It's unbelievable. Yeah.
So Simon makes a really good living arranging music. That's you yeah. know, that's his
well,
job.
I get that.
Yeah,
you make a really good living, and I make a good living playing. You know,
yeah.
for
shows. Because you play on the West End.
I do a lot of West End stuff. I play for you know Leo Sayer, Tony Christie. So I'm doing all that other stuff. But that stuff funds this stuff. You
yeah.
know, these are the you know if we've both talked about this so much that if we won the lottery tomorrow, one of the first things we'd do is just organise and pay for a massive tour
yeah.
for the band. We'd just book yeah. the venues. We'd pay for the venues. And we look after the fellas, and yeah. you know that's what we want to do because this is our you know it's an expensive hobby, but we're not yeah. going to stop doing it because we haven't got 100 dates a year in the book.
Expensive hobby is a phrase that's used every show as well.
You know? well, I mean, is it any more expensive than a lot of people's hobbies? You know, my other passion is motorcycling, and that's costing me a few bob. I can tell you.
Yeah.
But the rewards that you get from something that's—I mean—we're passionate musicians anyway. You know, no matter what job we're doing, we're always committed to it 100%.
Yeah.
You know, people often say to me, "Oh, can you just scribble out a chart today?" So just do it on the. No, I can't do it. I have to give it because I always think that that's the one that's going to bite you up the backside.
Yeah.
The one, you know, and Elliot will quote one particular example of that. Is it because it's on his toilet? Wall at the moment.
I turned up to a gig once and he'd written a version of Let There Be Love, the jazz standard.
Yeah.
He'd written it in 12/8
right.
to make it swing instead of actually swing quavers.
I see.
But I
phoned him up after the gig and left a really abusive. I was drunk, obviously.
I was doing a Ray Charles tribute show at the Haymarket. You know, I used to work in the West End as well.
Yeah.
And we came out of the interval and I switched my phone on and I just got this horrendous voicemail from Elliot Simon Williscroft about who writes Let There Be Love in 12/8 anyway, in hysterics down the phone. I had to hold my phone away from my ear.
So as a wedding present to me, he framed the first page of it in 12/8 and I've got it on my wall in my toilet.
Oh, wonderful.
I must just add at the end of that story that I did write it in 12/8 because it was a classical pianist. It was her version of it, and the only way she was going to get anywhere near swing vibe was to do it in the 12/8 because they just don't get it. But of course, you know, be careful when you make those decisions.
But getting back to how hard it is, and you know, you do get days with the knockbacks, trying to get gigs, trying to get anything happening.
Yeah.
You know, and you think, oh, what am I doing this for? You know.
Yeah.
And I think
there are so many.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Great.
Thank you. For every two or three of those knockbacks and those days where you think, oh, what is this really worth it? You know, what am I doing this for? You know, then something happens that blows your mind and goes, oh, yeah, this is why I'm doing it. And one of those things happened recently. We've got a few special guests on the album. We've got, as Simon mentioned, David Benoit, who's like, I mean, I've been listening to David Benoit play the piano since I was a teenager. He was one of the first GRP artists signed, kind of credited, rightly or wrongly, as the godfather of smooth jazz. I mean, he hates that title.
Yeah.
You know, I chatted to him about it. You know, although you know he made a lot of money out of it in the 80s and 90s. but he's, for those not familiar with him, he's you know, along the same sort of lines as Dave Grusin in Lee Ritner, that kind of vibe.
Yeah.
And I've been lucky enough to play some gigs with him in London when he comes over. I've done about 3 or 4 years with him now. And we asked him to play on this record, one of his tracks. And he was, you know, he played on it and he was amazing. We took a laptop down to Pizza Express and he put the headphones on, had us in the cans, and he played a beautiful piano solo to one of the tracks that he'd written.
Oh, wow, that's awesome.
And we've got Andy Snitzer on the record as well, who's a New York-based saxophone player who currently on tour with Paul Simon, but he's played with... the guy's played with everyone.
He played my favourite pop sax solo of ever, Wait for the Star to Fall. It's like, to me, that was the definitive solo.
Yeah.
So to get him playing on the album... through a mutual friend who's a good friend of his, and I managed to get hold of him. And of course, when we were over at NAMM in LA recently, we met up with him, had lunch with him, and everything.
Yeah.
He's a really top guy.
And
to have him playing on the title track, which is a Tom Scott track, Night Creatures, was just an honour to have that voice, his incredibly strong voice and powerful playing on the album. And when we were putting the track listings together for the album, it just became apparent that we had to have him on the opening track because it's such a hard hit.
Yeah. Are the tracks, are there originals?
It's a mixture of originals and basically our favourite tunes.
Right, okay.
Orchestrated for the full big band lineup and full string sections. So we've taken them and added our twist to them.
Yeah.
We'd like to think we've added that extra edge, that extra lushness to the strings.
Because I listen to Spain.
A labour of love, that arrangement, really. I mean, there's a lot of dog walks and procrastinating over voicings and things in that particular
Well, it's so polished, though. It's so ridiculous. You know, it really does
like
that
it,
tune justice. It sounds damn hard to sing as well.
Yeah, well, we've tried singing along with it. I can't sing the first line, you know. So the amazing Annie Skates and Capital Voices, we're honoured by their presence on the album as well. And, of course, they absolutely nailed it, you know. So we had 6 of the top session singers in the country singing that on that.
Yeah.
So that was amazing. Such an honour to have them as well. But that was probably the, you know, as far as doing the arrangements and putting it together, that was probably the most demanding. Because I really wanted to take it to another level there with like sort of Vince Mendoza kind of string arranging, but still sort of true to the original and also true to, sort of big fan of the Al Jarreau version of this.
Yeah.
So it's paying homage to that a lot, but utilising the full big band.
Yeah.
I had sort of like that Vince Mendoza, Michel Camilo, big band, all sort of coming together idea behind it, really. I sort of build it from there. But yeah, there was a lot of procrastinating exactly how that was going to work, you know. So I mean, quite often feel that when I go took the dog for a walk, it would be the time I'd reflect over and I'd come back and, oh, right, okay, that might be the solution to that problem.
Yeah.
You know, so then get back on the computer and try it out. And the beauty of the computer now is you can try it out and experiment with it. So you've got a good idea of what it's going to sound like. So by the time the band come in and play it, it's going to sound 10 times better. So if it sounds great on the computer, it's going to sound amazing when the guys get their hands on it. As it did, you know, it took it to a whole other level, you know. So it was very exciting, very exciting.
So do you have to slim it down when you want to play live?
Well, we've got two formats. Well, we've got three basic formats that we tend to go at, because obviously not a lot of venues, for many reasons, the size of the band and the expenses. You just can't go out with a full big band and a whole nine. Well, there was nine strings, but there were triple tracks on the album. You can't take that onto live. You know, it's very hard to get that going. So we go out. I've reorchestrated a lot of the charts for the smaller nine-piece lineup as well.
Yeah.
So it's all revoiced because it just doesn't work, you know, taking out
the
lead parts and hoping it's going to sound fine. So I've actually toned it all down for the nine-piece. So, but it still retains all the musical integrity of the original arrangements, you know. And as far as the general public goes, because it's everybody's such a strong player anyway, and if it's well written, it'll still sound massive. You've got some safe deal.
Yeah, we've done a couple of gigs with the nine-piece version. we did last year, Jazz at the Pantiles in Tunbridge Wells,
We've just got that confirmed for this year as well. We're going to be on August the 23rd, Thursday, August the 23rd, with an all-star lineup again. Yeah. We've got our A team down.
Great.
You know, so that's going to be an exciting night down in Tunbridge Wells and that night. So on the Pantiles, August the 23rd.
Oh, sweet.
But it's nice to be able to, and with Simon being such a great arranger, it's nice to have that option to, if we want to play somewhere small and intimate, like, say, the 606 or something like that. We can turn up, even with a set, you know, three horns and rhythm section, and Simon will work the magic with the writing.
Yeah,
and it'll still have that vibe that we've created with the album, but it won't be the full.
I think that's an important part of it. I mean, obviously, as an arranger, it's, you know, I don't sort of skimp on that side of it. I'm sort of quite fussy about it. You know, being a sax player myself, I don't want to sit there playing a really weird middle harmony part on tenor where there's only three horns there.
Yeah.
You know? So I'm very careful about how I rework things to still make sure it's got that punch. You know, it may not have the five trombone parts that were on the album or whatever, you know, but trust me, when these guys are kicking off, you really don't miss it that much. It's still a big noise and a big strong noise, you know. He's such a strong player that it's not just about the lead players in the band.
Yeah.
Everybody's so strong. It creates this big, fat sound.
So how do you write originals?
Well, Elliot, the composer of the original thing, it's quite unusual for a drummer to be musical, but he is. He's got an incredible gift of melody and ideas. You know, he's a big sort of Dave Grusin fan. He likes those kind of melodies.
Yeah.
So he's a big James Taylor fan. Yeah. So he loves a nice tune, you know. Me too. I was brought up listening to like American style theme tunes. I used to love all the American theme tunes and stuff. And it was all so well produced and so melodic and everything. And I thought we wanted to create that sort of element to it. So in some of Elliot's original tunes, we added some of those sort of Grusin-y kind of harmonies underneath it and pads and effects and the horn section on top. So to take it to another level again. Yeah. But once again, it's a really important factor about the band that everything's got a catchy tune. There's nothing on the album you'd consider to be an album track, you know, inverted commas. But
for me, it is all about the melody. When I used to run a small version of a five piece version under my own name, nothing to do with Spice Fusion, and everything I wrote for that band. And I'm not a prolific writer by any stretch of the imagination. Sometimes I'll be walking down the street and a melody will come into my head and I'll sing it into my dictaphone. And,
Ask you about that.
And then I'll work with it. I'm not the sort of person who will go, right, today I'm going to write something and go shut myself away and make it happen. Yeah. I can't do that. I'm not that guy. But I went through a phase where, you know, I'll be influenced by something. I'll be listening to something. I'll say, whether something subconsciously has gone in, and then, you know, I can always trace back to the tunes that I've written what's inspired it.
Yeah.
You know? But I'm not... I'm not massively comfortable with harmony. I don't know too much about harmony. So what I tend to do is I'll come up with a melody. I'll know in my head what I want the harmony to do.
Yeah.
I can hear it in my head. Mm-hmm. I'll go around to Simon. And Simon's brilliant with harmony. He'll sit at the piano. I'll write out the melody.
Yeah.
He'll play the melody on the piano. He'll say, well, these are your choices to go underneath that.
Yeah.
And he'll play me loads of options. And I know which one it is when I hear it. I go, yeah, it's that one.
Like an eye test.
Yeah. And that's kind of how it happens. But I always wanted, whenever I write, I always wanted that melodic thing to be really strong. Because for me, when I'm playing drums behind an artist or an instrumentalist, I'm singing their part while I'm playing.
Yeah.
Melody's so important for me.
And I think, and I appreciate that as well, and when I'm doing the arrangements, I try and be true to that. Too often, you get... using fancy chords and taking it into this strange world, But I like to be still quite traditional as far as the harmony goes.
Yeah.
We still take a few risks and a few chances with it, but I think I still want to keep it, and I hesitate to use the word commercial because it's got such a bad...
Yeah.
What about rap these days? Commercial seems to say, particularly among musicians, you say use the word commercial. But I actually think it means it's easy on the ear, it works, it's satisfying, it's rewarding, and it's not going to make you jar at all.
Yeah.
And I think I'm very one, you can do it, can reharmonise in a nice way and still make it modern, commercial, and jazzy, but still appeal to a lot of people without taking it to another place.
Yeah. I think that for me, when we were coming up with the idea of doing this, 2013, I think it was, we set the band up, we did the first gig, didn't we? For me, there are so many people, and take nothing away from it, I've played for a lot of them, but there are so many big bands out there, and we've sort of, not argued, but we've discussed so many times, when people ask us what it is, if you say to them, well, we're a big band, they're automatically expecting swing, they're expecting Glenn Miller, Count Basie, Frank Sinatra.
None of that.
we are none of that. One of the things we stipulated was we want to be a big band, but we don't want any swing in there at all.
Yeah.
There are bands out there that do that better than anyone, but what I find with a lot of big bands now, and I get it, and it's the same, it's the kind of stars in their eyes thing that's going on at the moment. Everyone wants a tribute act. But so many bands are doing tribute to Basie, tribute to Ellington, tribute to Glenn Miller, tribute to this.
Yeah.
It's like, those guys, Ellington wasn't doing a tribute to anyone when he did it the first time around.
Yeah.
Basie wasn't. None of them were. No. Jazz is meant to move forward.
Yeah, definitely.
And, and I think for me, it was about doing a big band that had a modern sound, it was forward thinking, but it was the idea of the word commercial being a kind of a down thing, a negative thing.
Yeah.
I don't think it is, because...
It just sounds
because
good,
because Glenn Miller in the 30s was commercial.
Yeah. That was pop music.
That was the pop music of the time.
As
was all that. It was a dance band.
Yeah.
And I think for me, where I'd like to see our band, the dream for us is that when artists come over to this country or they want to do that kind of thing, they come to us as their go-to guys, because they know we can put that sound together.
Yeah.
We had an idea. It may happen, it may not, but we had an idea where we would do albums or concerts of artists along the standard of people like Chaka Khan or Michael McDonald, all our favourite artists, but they do their classic albums arranged for the big band, played by us,
This is copyrighted, by the way. You cannot nick that idea. Can I just say to anybody? That's a painted in idea.
Yeah, that's a fantastic idea as
but,
well.
But I think that's where big bands have to go now. Otherwise, everyone's just going to be paying tribute to the old greats. And they are the old greats. I've got so many records of those guys, but it has to move forward, surely. Yeah.
It does have to move forward. Listen to the original as well.
Yeah, if you're going to be doing albums, you're not going to do an album tribute. I wouldn't do a tribute to Buddy Rich album,
because
if I want to hear Buddy Rich, I'm not going to hear me do a half-assed tribute to it. I'm going to hear Buddy Rich do it. That's the album I'm going to buy.
We're not seeing this as some sort of groundbreaking project or anything, or some earth-shattering thing. We just want to sort of say there is other options out there apart from doing the tribute thing. I like revisiting classic songs that we love, material we love, as well as incorporating original material.
Yeah.
But incorporating the vibe that we enjoy, you can obviously, people have already started drawing parallels to like the GRB big band and Gordon Goodwin's big fat band. And we're none of those, really. But we mainly use contemporary players, players who mainly do a lot of pop work.
Yeah.
So the band, the horn section, sounds quite edgy and Tower Power-like.
It's crisp.
It's crisp and punchy at that level.
Yeah.
And so that's all. Certainly that's something I bear in mind when I'm doing the orchestrations, that I want to sort of be true to the original, but take it up a level and sort of add certain things, textures or whatever. So I don't see this as a sort of groundbreaking project, more of as a vehicle, so that there are other options, commercial options within that format.
Yeah.
So, because there's other people that do that so well, there's no way we're going to tread on the toes. We did originally, I think one of the concepts when we started was based on the fact that I did 4 big band arrangements, and we produced them down on the South Coast for a singer down there, and that was sort of like, okay, yeah, this big band thing works, you know, and the players got used to the sound of those swing things, and we incorporated a few of those swing numbers in the middle of a gig that we did, and I know and a couple of people just said the band sounds amazing, but I don't think it's not swing band, you know. Maybe you should just drop that, you know. And so we decided that let's just focus on that. You know, there's so many bands that do the swing stuff so amazingly well. We're not a swing band, you know.
How many years since Spice Fusion started now?
So 2013 was the first gig.
Right.
And it really was a gig where a friend of mine was running a Sunday lunch big band gig where he was getting different big bands out, and he phoned me up and he said, do you want to put a band together and come and do something in a couple of weeks' time? So I said, well, I'd love to, because I've never run a big band before.
Yeah.
And it was just a one-off gig at that point, so I called Simon. And it's something Simon and I had been discussing about doing, you know, the pipe dream, or one day we'll have our own big band and play the music we want to play.
Yeah.
And this platform, because it was just a knock on a Sunday lunchtime, it was like, well, we can do what we wanted. They didn't specify, you know, it's got to be this, it's got to be that. Yeah. It was like, just get a band together and come and do your thing. So I spoke to Simon, we put a track listing together of our favourite tunes, most of which Simon had on file already.
Yeah.
But I ended up actually, there's a lot of work went into that first gig because I suddenly went. And I thought, Christ, you got me, because even on that first gig, got an amazing lineup on that band.
We did, yeah.
And I thought, well, this is a chance to really do something special here.
Yeah.
And so I sort of picked up on it, and we got some of the Ed Calais arrangements on the first album. There's just a couple of Latin tracks, and I managed to get hold of the arrangements, but I reworked them for the band and everything. So, but that was just doing those two was about, you know, 4 days' work sorting out those alone. And for this Sunday lunchtime, I was already negative time wise. But ever such the case, you know. But it was worth it because that effort pays off. I mean, even for me, just sitting there and hear the guys playing the charts, it was enough to pay off, you know.
Yeah.
It's great.
So where can we buy the album's out now?
The album's out. Yeah, Trying Hard 2 is out now. It's on all the regular platforms: iTunes, Spotify, Amazon, CD Baby. You can order it through our website, which is spicefusion.co.uk. We've also got download cards, and you can order hard copies of both albums off the website.
Oh, great!
Yeah, it's all down there, and the vinyl will be out within the next couple of months. So hopefully, people who will, I know a lot of cars and computers don't even have a CD player now.
Yeah.
So the vinyl will be available soon, but the download cards are available as well.
Oh, fantastic! Yeah.
And the first album, we've managed to get Eric Marienthal to play a track on that.
Cool.
He plays on a David Sanborn track called Butterfat.
That's right.
Oh, amazing.
And he did a 32-bar solo for us. We sent it over to him in LA, and he sent back 2 takes.
Which I've still got on my desktop.
Yeah, great. He sent back 2 takes, and we wanted to paste them together and have a 64-bar solo.
Yeah.
It was so good what he played.
That was a hard decision deciding.
And that's the other thing is that, you know, I've very much been if it's going to happen, I want to at least ask the question. And when we were talking about that particular solo, we were exploring who was going to play that solo, and Simon said, well, should we get a guest soloist in, you know, a UK jazz guy or something, you know. And I said, well, hang on, who would be your number one in the world to play that solo?
Yeah.
I said, I know who mine would be, and we both said Eric Marienthal, because Eric, you know, I'm a wannabe sax player.
Yeah.
In fact, I used to play alto when I was 11.
Sweet.
But I'm a big fan of Eric, and anyone with that, you know, Sanborn, I love Sanborn, all that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
So we both said Eric. So I said, okay, well, leave it with me. And I got in touch with him via his website, spoke to his manager. The fee that they came back with initially was astronomical, and quite rightly, he's one of the best players in the world. And I went back and said, we're self-funded, we can't afford that, but thank you, you know.
Yeah.
And then they came back and said, well, what kind of money have you got? And we told them what we had.
Yeah.
And they said, yeah, he'll do that. He'll do that. Send him it through. And then we got his email and we dealt with him personally, and he was a joy.
Great.
You know?
That's amazing.
And we've met him a few times since when he's been over with the various bands that he does, Jeff Lorber and Chick Corea. And he's been beautiful. And, he was at the time, he was very complimentary about the band.
Yeah.
In the same way,
but not so much anymore.
Sorry, but not so much now. It's all gone. He thinks he was mistaken.
I bumped into him at Pizza Express when he was over a couple of weeks ago with Michael Linton doing a show down there, and I gave him a copy of the new CD.
Oh,
that
great!
He's on,
yeah,
wasn't happy about that. Who's this Andy Snitzer guy? He says.
but everyone that you know, Andy Snitzer, he's been beautiful. We're hopefully trying to get a gig together where Andy Snitzer and David Benoit come over and trying to get a big album launch gig for September at Cadogan Hall in London.
Oh, wow.
And we're going to have the full big band, the strings, and everyone who played on it, basically.
Yeah.
All the guests.
Yeah.
Big budget. We've got our friend Toby Cruz, who's a great promoter, friend of mine, who promoted the Buddy Rich Memorial concert that I did in 2012 at the Palladium.
Yeah.
So we're at the process of dealing with the figures now, how much it's all going to cost.
That'd be incredible.
But both Andy Snitzer and David Benoit, when they heard that this was a possibility, they were all over it. They were like, we really want to be involved with this, you know.
Yeah.
And Simon and I were in LA recently, and we went round to David Benoit's house, and this was what I was saying before about the moments that make it all worthwhile.
Yeah.
We're in LA. We went round to David Benoit's house, which is this incredible house that he designed. Yeah. Up in the hills of Hollywood, and we got in there, and we're sat in his kitchen having breakfast with him.
Yeah.
And our album's playing on his stereo, and he's asking us about it, and it was just like, this is surreal.
Yeah.
You know, I've listened to so many of his albums in my kitchen, and now he's listening to my album in his kitchen. You know, it's like, wow.
Yeah.
So he got his own radio show over there, and be playing the CD over there as well.
Oh, amazing!
So we're hoping for some American airtime as well. So that'd be amazing.
So between that and breakfast in Sunbury with me, things are looking good.
It's, you know, it's all those little defining moments of the process.
But it's an amazing place. The whole trip to LA was just like all the dreams, you know, it's where people live their dreams. And you can see it because we were there for 5 days.
Yeah.
And from start to finish, it was just a tsunami of meeting people and going to amazing places. And even on the very last day, we were there sitting having breakfast with Steve.
Kill me for forgetting. This pianist, it'll come to me in a minute.
And it was like a top Hollywood arranger. They've got to remember his name for this.
Steve Torme is the guy he's MD for, who's Mel Torme's son, who I play for when he comes over to the UK.
Cool.
It'll come to me.
Anyway, so we're sitting there having the last rest, and he made this call to a friend of his, and the next thing we know, we're walking around Capitol Studios, bumping into Al Schmidt and everything, and we're on a plane in like 2 hours.
Yeah.
And so, like, literally, up to the last minute, it was an amazing trip, you know, and we were starting discussing the possibility of maybe doing an album there.
Yeah.
And everything.
Well, that's the next pipe dream, we're going to get a quote from Capitol Studios to how much it would be to book Studio A for the day, get all the top LA session guys in.
That would be,
and just do one something. Day like we did over here, you know.
Yeah.
It's all about budget at the end of the day.
Yeah.
If we can raise the finances, we'll do it. It's not a case of, oh, well, that'll never happen.
Yeah.
If we can afford it and we can make it work, we'll do it. It's as simple as that.
That's an important point, isn't it? That, you know, you've got to make things happen yourself. Yeah. You've got to work. You know, we work hard, we practice hard, we're very businesslike about what we do. And you have to follow that through with putting your money where your mouth is sometimes as well. Obviously in the right place and do your research. But for us, you know, investing in doing an album, even if we're doing it here, doing it Abbey Road, just to have Abbey Road on the back of the album would have so much kudos to the project and be a worthwhile investment, you know, if we could afford that, you know. But and the same with if we did an album at Capitol over in LA as well, it'd be the same thing, you know. If we got that kudos of that on there, it'd be certainly a worthwhile investment. So, you know, Steve Rawlings.
That was the guy. Sorry, Steve.
So you can edit this in now. We were having brunch with Steve Rawlings and he made his phone call to Capitol.
Yeah, he's
so you can edit
guy.
That in now. Steve Rawlins.
Great.
Steve Rawlins.
Chris Trace. Amazing. Yeah. Chris Trace. One more for Chris.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Obviously, the good thing about the project as well is that it's become more like a family. We've got our wives are very much involved. My wife Eva does all the media marketing and PR work there as well. She's a labour of love there. She's very passionate and supportive of the project as well. And also we've got a manager, Jotty Bansi, as well, has been helping us. Now he's been in contact with David Foster's office in LA and doing a lot of pushing there. He puts in touch with Paul Jolly at 33 as well. Things are moving there.
Yeah.
Obviously Toby Cruz as well, he's well into the project, offering his advice and helping promote. So we've got a lot of people behind the scenes already who are on board. And
It's just getting it out there, I think. You know, the people that we're getting endorsements from, people, you know, like those guys. You know, those guys, Toby, Jotty, Chris Traves, of course, your wife, Eva. They're all really busy people. Do you know what I mean? They've all got loads of other things going, and they're giving their time selflessly, you know, because they love the project.
Yeah.
And my wife as well, Lara, she's, you know, she... full-time job, two kids, but she'll spend the time. She's you know, she likes, knows good music when she hears it, I like to think, and she really loves the band. And the kids wear the Spice Fusion t-shirts that we put out, you know, they all love it. And I think it's a nice testament that not only people in the quality, in, you know, as high up in the business as people like David Benoit, Eric Marienthal, love it, which is a great endorsement, but people who aren't professional musicians say, we really like this, we'd go and see this band.
I think it is a very important point, that. And I remember when I was talking to Snake Davis about this, he said he's not just playing for, you know, the guy who's a musician or anything, he's playing for his girlfriend as well, and family who've come to the gig.
Yeah.
It's important to keep your feet on the ground as far as that's concerned.
Yeah.
So again, we come back to the commercial aspect of it. We want to appeal to as many people. Who doesn't want to appeal to as many people as possible?
Yeah.
You know, and that's a lot of what it's about. But we're fortunate in that we're sort of, in inverted, quite commercial people, and that we like.
And I think it's a nice antidote in an age where everything's, music is very much, you know, getting smaller and smaller, less people in bands.
Yeah.
Backing track mentality.
Everything's,
you know,
based.
We're going the other way. The first album was big band. The next album's added a string section to it.
Yeah.
We're going the other way. You know, if you think about it, in this country, there are so many talented musicians. Why wouldn't you want to get 20 of them on stage playing music?
Yeah.
You know, that's what we should be doing.
Yeah. And also, most of the members of the band tend to be sidemen working for other people with West End shows or backing pop acts or whatever around the world. And so it's nice that everybody comes from behind a little bit, you know. It's a vehicle for them as well to get out from the pit or out from behind.
Get some fresh air.
And I must say, everybody's been involved with the project, whether it be playing in the band or listening to it or behind the scenes. I've actually been just so enthralled by it and just said, you know, often we come off from a gig or a session and just, man, that's been one of the best days of my career or something. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And it's a huge compliment, you know. So.
Yeah. Well, Elliot, Simon, thank you so much
for
coming on the Jazz Podcast.
It's an absolute pleasure.
We've had a great time.
Thanks for asking us.
I hope you've enjoyed listening to the Jazz Podcast. We'll see you again in 2 weeks' time for Matt Roberts. This track's another beauty from their brand new album. This one's called Along Came Me.